Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is the godfather of gay diversity training, author, activist, and lecturer, Brian McNaught. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you, Art. It's good to be here. Thank you for asking me.
You're quite welcome. I've spent a couple of years now kind of digging into the history of gay bars all over the country. And I'm kind of happy to know that you've got a history going back both politically and in the gay scene for almost 50 years.
That's
so let's start off with the beginning. Back in the 1970s, 1974, you were writing for a paper called The Michigan Catholic.
That's right. Art, in 1970, I filed as a conscientious objector against the war in Vietnam. And miraculously, my draft board accepted it. And the alternative service that I was assigned to do was approved to be at the diocesan newspaper. So for the first 2 years that I was there, it was satisfying a selective service requirement. But the whole time I was there, I had a column, a weekly column aimed at people my age, which would have been post-college. But it was very active in the civil rights time. You know, just everything was happening at that time. And I also was a reporter for the paper. And in 1974, I found out about Dignity, which is a gay Catholic organization. And a local priest that I talked to introduced me to a handful of other gay men who were also Catholic. And so I wrote to the National Office of Dignity and I said I wanted to start a Detroit chapter. And they said, great, that's terrific. So I started the Detroit chapter. And soon after that, the religion editor of the Detroit News, who was actually a good friend of mine, called and she said, Brian, I'm writing a story about homosexuality and religion. And the diocese gave me this telephone number for Dignity. And I said, yeah, I said, I'm gay. I said, I haven't come out, you know, to you before. But she said, well, would you be in the story? And I said, yes. You know, Art, somebody asked me not long ago. So, you know, why did you say yes? Because if you had said no, you know, you probably wouldn't have been fired. But I've said yes to the universe ever since I was little. You know, my whole thing is service. I believe in service. And so there was no way that people were going to find out about Dignity if I said no to the article. So the next day, the Detroit News, which is the biggest newspaper in town, had this big story about homosexuality and religion. They had a picture of me. And when I went to work on Monday, they called me into the editor's office and they said, we're dropping your column. And I said, why? And they said, because we've had so many people call and threaten to cancel their subscriptions or their advertising if we don't do something about you. And I said, okay. So I went back to my desk and the reporter called. She said, hey, has there been any reaction to my article? I said, yeah, they just dropped my column. So the next day, the Detroit News had an 8-column headline, Catholic newspaper drops column by homosexual. And that totally changed my life. It, you know, I had hoped that one day I might be the religion editor of the New York Times because I loved faith and I loved writing. But I immediately got emerged in an unintended but very rewarding career of doing public education on gay issues, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and now queer issues.
I can absolutely relate to that. I'm a little younger than you. In 1974, yeah. I was in high school, but I am a recovering Catholic, so I can understand the whole mindset of the Catholic Church and the world at large toward homosexuality. And I'm sure that must have been a big blow to you to be publicly outed on this newspaper in a major city. And to have everybody you knew suddenly know that you were gay.
You know, Art, my folks knew before I came out publicly. I made sure that happened. And, you know, a lot of my close friends, in fact, everyone at work I took out to lunch. See, one of the things that's important to say that was that when I was 26, and I was in a relationship with an Episcopal priest, and it wasn't working. And I was so sure that breaking up with him would mean that I could never be with anyone else because, you know, I was a divorced Catholic. I took it very seriously. And so in a panic, I drank a bottle of turpentine and took, you know, all the pills in the medicine cabinet because I wanted to die. I didn't want to live any longer. And I'm one of seven kids. My folks had already lost two. And I was the sort of super achiever in the family. So I thought, what have you done? You know, so I drove down the street, actually just a couple blocks. There was a Catholic hospital. I told them what I did. They pumped my stomach. And I promised myself then, as I, you know, cried on the emergency room table, that I was never going to live my life again based on people's images or expectations of me. And so I had told everyone at work that I was gay because I didn't want it to be a secret anymore. I couldn't live with the secret. So when I came out in the Detroit News, the hard part was that my parents already knew, but all of the attention that it got, I mean, it was like wildfire. The Detroit News article led to the Detroit Free Press, and then every television station, every radio station in town, every talk show wanted an interview. And, you know, I said yes to all of them because how else were people going to know about dignity and about the fact that you could be gay and Catholic without conflict? How are they going to find out about that if I didn't go on the show? And, you know, if you interview people from the early days of Detroit, actually, they say in a book, you know, Brian McNaught came out of nowhere because, you know, I was this sort of upper middle class, well-educated Catholic, who was actually loved by a lot of the readers of his column. So the conflict was more for my family in terms of all the publicity that I got. I felt like I was on a mission. I wasn't devastated at all. In fact, you may or may not know this, that after they dropped my column, I went on a hunger fast. And I said that I was only going to drink water until they pledged to educate the clergy, because I've always known that if you just educate people about homosexuality, it will change their beliefs. So I was on the fast for 24 days. It ended when the bishops in Detroit pledged to work to educate the clergy. I went off the fast and I was fired by the newspaper the next day. And that, you know, so then a bunch of gay newspapers wrote to me and said, well, you wrote a column for the Michigan Catholic. Why don't you write a column for us? So I wrote a syndicated column in the gay press for 12 years in about 10 newspapers. After a couple years, I was the most out person in Detroit and Michigan. I used to get phone calls in the middle of the night from all over the country, often from people who were drunk because they couldn't build up the courage to call without a couple drinks. And when I say people from all over in every level, I had closeted bishops who called me and needed to talk because, you know, they'd never met anybody, a lay person like me, who is not just out, but articulate and happy and, you know, who believe that, you know, through my columns communicated clearly that, you know, there's being gay is something to be celebrated, not something to be ashamed of. And, but Dignity had a national headquarters in Boston. And my grandparents lived nearby, and I spent much of my summers in New England. I loved it. And so I heard about two guys who had an apartment, and they needed a third roommate. They heard about me, and they called me from Boston and asked if I wanted to be the roommate. And I said yes. So I packed my Irish setter, Jeremy, and my 5x8 trailer, U-Haul trailer, traveled from Detroit to Boston and met Ray Struble, who was my roommate. One of the two, and he and I have been together for 45 years.
Well, congratulations. I know that's not an easy task.
Yeah, well, you know what? It's as anyone in a relationship that has endured knows, it's hard work. but it's worth it because you reach levels of love you never would have otherwise experienced because of the challenges, I think, that you face. But at any rate, so I worked with Dignity for a while as head of social action. Dignity had a real, and still does, this problem of, are we an organization that wants to have people be able to come to Mass safely, or are we an organization that wants to challenge the church's teachings? And I, of course, came down hard on the challenge the church. Any opportunity you get, challenge them, challenge Bishop, challenge them. So after a couple of years, I heard that the mayor of Boston was going to hire someone to be his liaison to the gay community. There was no such position in the country. It was the first time. His name was Kevin White. And so I applied, among others, and I was hired. So I was the mayor of Boston's liaison to the gay community from 1982 to 1984, still writing my column in the gay press, and now writing a regular column in Boston to update all the gay people in Boston as to what was happening. And then you know what happened in 1982, Art. I got a call from a friend, and I actually, the notes that I took, misspelling Carposi sarcoma and pneumocystis carini pneumonia. But, you know, in 1983, I started the Mayor's Task Force on AIDS in Boston. And we were the first city to have a mayor-sponsored task force, bringing together people from the Red Cross, people from the bars, you know, because, but, you know, the bars are really important means of communicating accurate information to people. People from public health, city hospitals, the state epidemiologist. So we would meet regularly and release everything we learned, you know, but, you know, was paupers involved, you know, was oral sex involved? How do you get AIDS? Ray and I moved from Boston to Gloucester, which is about an hour and a half away. And we hosted the first meeting of anybody with AIDS in Massachusetts. These guys were never allowed to meet each other because there was fear, you know, of contagion, that somebody might pick up a new strain. So they came to our house, many of them walking skeletons, but had the first time in their life a joyful, happy moment with other people who also had their disease. And as you know, it just, you know, it got worse and worse and worse from that. But so part of my job was addressing the issue. And, you know, going back to the focus of your archives, I worked hard with the bar owners and managers in Boston to help address this issue.
Now, you need to put this time frame in perspective.
Yep.
I lived briefly in Boston at the same time before you started working with Kevin White. My first year of college, which was 77, 78, I was at Boston University. And Boston was kind of an oxymoron at that time, because the mayor prior to Kevin White was accused of being a racist, I believe. She was not very open-minded, and the situation there was very tenuous. There was a lot of racial tension at Boston University, I know. In fact, the first day that I was there, moving into my dorm, in an adjoining dorm, there was a freshman, I think, or sophomore college student who was killed by his roommate because apparently they paired a black and a white student together, and that particular student didn't like having a black roommate. And so it was kind of tenuous in that respect, because there was a lot of racial tension in Boston in the late 70s, early 80s. But the flip side of it is, as you mentioned, the bars. Boston had three gay bars at that time that had all been open since around the 1930s. There was one called the Napoleon Club, which opened in 1929 originally. There was one called Playland, which opened in 1937, and one which is still operating, Jacques Cabaret, which opened in 38. So on one hand, you had a very conservative, racist, political environment. And on the other hand, you had a long established history of safe places for gays and lesbians to go. So yeah. It was kind of odd. And for Kevin White to step forward and look for someone like you to be an articulate intellectual representative of the gay community in his administration as a full-time employee, not just a casual commenter, right. It was pretty groundbreaking. I mean, that was a pretty big deal.
It was a big deal. And, you know, one of the first things I did was ask that there be a police liaison. You know, there was no liaisons in the police department for the gay community. And I explained to the police chief and to the mayor that gay people often won't go to the police for fear they're going to get mocked. You know, that they get robbed in their apartment. They're afraid that the cops are going to show up, see that it's a one bedroom apartment with two men, and then start, you know, mincing and using, you know, limp wrists because they hadn't had any training yet. You know, one of my jobs was training the police department so that officers knew that if you really want the support of the gay community, you have to create an environment in which they feel safe and respected. So this straight police lieutenant by the name of Don Devine volunteered to be the liaison. And, you know, he and I stood side by side at every gay pride parade then. And, you know, he made sure that, you know, the police behaved properly with gay people. So, yeah, Kevin was a real progressive. I mean, he could have been, you know, a vice presidential candidate, but he really made Boston. That's my dog, Lincoln. He really made Boston the, you know, they call it the hub of the universe because of all the universities. And he was not racist himself. He had a, you know, a great staff that addressed as many issues as came up. I was really proud to work for him. And while you say there were three bars there, you know, there were dozens of bars, but none from the 30s.
Right. That was fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Dozens of bars. And when I was there were two incidences when I really needed help from the bartenders and bar owners and bar managers. One was AIDS and making sure that we were all on board, you know, on the same book and the same page, telling the same facts through the bartenders to the people in the bars. And then there was another one that I wrote to you about, which was that one bar owner deliberately and consciously broke the law every single night by serving alcohol after curfew. After the point where you weren't allowed to serve alcohol, he served alcohol on purpose. And so I had to get the other bar owners on my side in, you know, letting them know that the police weren't going to tolerate this. And they were all reasonable, good people, and they respected me. And the mayor said to me years later, I have to thank you for stopping me from making a huge mistake. And the only thing that I could come up with was that I talked them out of raiding the bar, because the bar owner wanted the police to raid the bar so that he could have another stonewall. You know, he said, we're going to have a stonewall in Boston. It's going to be my bar. Well, they weren't anything alike, you know.
Right.
Stonewall Inn wasn't, you know, illegal. You know, this after hours club was illegal. But nevertheless, I made sure that we avoided any opportunity for them to fan the flames on the issue.
Now, the three long-running bars, gay bars in Boston at that time, were three completely different types of bars. Jacques Cabaret, which I think at that time was still known just as Jacques, was owned by Henry Vera, and he had been in the bar business a long time in Boston. He's over the years owned, I think, dozens of bars.
Yes, he did.
And Jacques Cabaret was kind of a show bar. At one time, it was predominantly women, but for the most part, it's been a show bar, and it had a different kind of environment. Have you ever visited there? Did you go to Jacques?
No. You know, I wasn't a big bar person. I mean, I found my Episcopal priest partner at the Woodward Bar in Detroit, with Neil Diamond singing "I Am What You Know I Am" in the background, and then I didn't want to go back to the bar because I already had my catch, right?
Right.
So and then when I moved to Boston, Ray and I would go to the 1270 and dance. A lot of Dignity people went to the 1270. The address was 1270 Boylston Street, so we went to the 1270. But Henry Barra, you know, you mentioning that name, boy, that brings back a lot of memories, because he did own a lot of bars.
And still does, by the way.
Oh, is that right?
He still owns Jacques.
Well, how old can he possibly be?
His father started the bar.
Okay.
And Henry Sr. And then Henry Jr. was born in, I believe, 1938, the same year that the bar was opened. So he's 83 years old now, and he's still alive. And then his son, Henry III, is still in Boston operating bars, including, I think, one called Our Place or something like that. He just recently sold the Crown and Anchor, which was in P-Town. The Veras owned that until, I think, November of last year.
No kidding.
The Jacques is still in the same family hands 83 years later. And I know they had some controversy with the law there because of neighborhood uprisings and people complaining, what have you. So he's no stranger to conflicts and controversy in Boston. But by contrast, another bar that was in Boston called Napoleon Club was the complete other end of the spectrum. It was an elite kind of, you know, it's the kind of place you would expect senators and attorneys and doctors and, you know, wealthy businessmen to go to. It had a dress code. It had a very lavish environment, and it was a very upscale gentleman's club, basically, and restaurant that was geared toward a higher echelon of gay men.
So yes, but and younger gay men called it the Wrinkle Room.
Yes. And it had a pretty long history there. And then going to the exact opposite end of the spectrum is Playland, which was in the combat zone and about the raunchiest, grittiest, lowest end of gay bars, I think, that might have existed in Boston, from what I've heard. Is that true?
Did you go to them?
What
bars did you go to? You were there.
I didn't. When I was at my first year in college, I had a boyfriend from high school. He was Jewish. And at Boston University, as you know, at least at that time, had a very high Jewish population. There were a lot of Jewish students there. The Hillel House at Boston University campus was monstrous. It was this big thing. And I think something like a third of the undergraduates there were Jewish. And my roommate was an anti-Semite who was descended from a Rhode Island senator, I think. Mm-hmm. And he was very snooty and very anti-Semitic and biased. And I never came out to anybody at Boston U. I would go travel down to Baltimore, which was where Mark went to school. And my first gay bar experience was at the Hippo in Baltimore one time when I was visiting Mark. So I never explored the gay bars in Boston. I went to some of the straight kind of music type clubs that were right around campus. I was at the west end of campus.
Art, you had a president, John Silber, who was homophobic.
Yeah.
He was a gay son, but he was homophobic.
He was a strange character. I remember John. I remember just before I got up there to go to college that I read an article. I want to say it was in U.S. News and World Report or Newsweek, one of the two, by Nora Ephron about John Silber. And I thought, oh, my God, what am I in for?
Yeah.
But the treacherous weather there that winter, the blizzard and all the snow and everything convinced me that I was going to transfer and go south. And so that's why I didn't stay in Boston. But I never experienced a Boston gay bar.
Okay. Well, you would have had, I mean, there was a bar called Buddy's that Michael Campbell owned. He was a great guy. I don't know if he's still alive, but really, you know, first class, great guy. And it was right on Boylston Street, I think.
Yeah.
It was a nice bar. I mean, you'd go in and you felt, you know, sophisticated. I mean, there were bar restaurants too.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, places that you could eat in Boston and there still are. I mean, the bar scene is, I think, probably still quite active in Boston because there's still young people coming out, you know, looking for others.
Yeah, and Buddy's lasted about 10 years in the Boylston Street location. And then I think they moved and they only lasted for maybe three or four years at their new location. They closed down completely in 1992 from what my research indicates.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Well, when I was there, you know, they were a nice place to go, you know, not dancing as much as you did at 1270, but, you know, having a drink with a friend. And that's, you know, this is about the time that my big book came out. My first book was called A Disturbed Peace, and it was a collection of my columns. And, oh, you know, one thing I want to mention that we haven't talked about, it was, you know, the night that we lost in Dade County to Anita Bryant. I stayed up all night and I wrote an open letter to Anita Bryant. It was called Dear Anita, Late Night Thoughts of an Irish Catholic Homosexual. And it got published in a national magazine, and Anita Bryant had her executive director call me at home to say that she really liked the article and she wanted to respond to it. Well, I didn't have the ability to give her the space in a magazine. But then I was flown down to Miami to debate Anita Bryant Ministries on a television talk show. And so my early book had the Dear Anita article in it. And also, while I was on my hunger fast, I was asked to write an article for the U.S. Catholic about being gay and Catholic. And believe it or not, the article, which was called The Sad Dilemma of the Gay Catholic, one best magazine article of the year in the Catholic Press Association. So anyway, my first book, A Disturbed Peace, was a collection of my writing. And then it morphed into On Being Gay. And a lot of people my age, I'll run into at parties or they'll see my name on Facebook and they'll say, oh my God, Brian, you saved my life. Because there wasn't much out there at the time to read. And here's this guy writing who, you know, has a great relationship with his family, is in a personal relationship that's ongoing, has a faith relationship, you know, with God. And they didn't know where else to find that. So a lot of people read On Being Gay at that time.
Yeah, I can relate to that because around that time frame, you know, I was starting to understand that there was a gay community because of having visited the Hippo. And then when I went back to school in Nashville, after I had transferred down there, I started exploring the gay bar scene there and realized, you know, when I was in high school and dating at that time, I thought that it was just a thing. Like, I didn't think it was a community. I didn't think it was a lifestyle. I didn't think it was anything that was going to continue throughout my life. I thought it was just something that I was doing for amusement or entertainment or whatever. And so I started looking for information about gay life back then. And the first thing I ran across, and I'm sure you're familiar with this book, it was a pretty popular book at the time. It was called Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask. And I remember going and looking up homosexuality in there.
Awful.
And to put in perspective for anybody listening that has not read that book, in my memory of what that book said about being gay was basically that gay men go to random public places, they anonymously bump into each other, have sex in a bathroom stall, and never speak to each other again.
Yeah, and it was horrible book. And I got certified as a sex educator, and every sex educator hates that book, you know. And it wasn't just misinformation on homosexuality. I read everything I could get my hands on, like Society and the Health of Homosexual. It was a really important book for me. And what you just said, I have a new book out called On Being Gay and Gray, Our Stories, Our Gifts, and the Meaning of Our Lives. And in it, I talk about how in the 50 years that I was been involved, we successfully changed public perception of homosexuality from it being an act that people engaged in into being who we are rather than what we do. You know, you mentioned Nashville. I spoke at, you know, over 100 colleges, and Nashville was one of them. In Nashville, I forget, is it Ellis? Is it, what's the college in Nashville?
There's quite a few, but was it Vanderbilt or?
Yeah, it was Vanderbilt. So, but at any rate, we successfully changed this from being a thing that people did, like you just said, to it being your identity. You know, I would tell people, being gay is not what I do. It's who I am.
Right.
And that transformed American culture. You know, all of us coming out and putting a face on the issue. And then people seeing us in relationships with children, right? So no group has ever done this as fast as we did it. But we went from being people who were described as hanging out around children's playgrounds to molest them. That was the image that was out there when I came out, to being these incredible people who want to adopt or have their own children, and who are great parents, according to all the studies. That's major change. You know? When I came out, one of the first groups I spoke to in Detroit was at a home, and the woman whose home it was greeted me at the door, and she said, "Brian, you know, we're glad you're here, but you should know that the lady in the green blazer says she's going to throw up when you walk in the room." And that was the level of fear that people had in 1974, of people who were, quote, avowed homosexuals, as they would say in the paper. Brian McNaught is an avowed homosexual. Sounds like I took vows, right? Or a practicing homosexual. Well, I got enough practice in. You don't need to say that. But she was the last one to leave that night, the lady in the green blazer, which is what really, really underscored for me the power of education. That if you give people the opportunity to ask questions, and to get past their fears, give them information, that you make allies out of them. And that's what I did. That's what I've been doing since 1974.
And another turning point for me was because Mark was going to college at Johns Hopkins. I went down there and I stayed with him, you know, sometimes for a few days or, you know, a week. And I had the pleasure of sitting in on a couple of lectures that were done by a professor there at Johns Hopkins who was groundbreaking in approaching issues of sexuality. His name was Dr. John Money. And I had the pleasure of sitting in on a couple of his lectures. Yeah. And he would actually, at that time, and we're talking about the late 70s here, we're not talking about, you know, 2010, he would have homosexual couple sit in front of his class and answer questions. He would introduce people to all these different aspects of sexuality. And I thought that was groundbreaking, and that kind of made a big impression as well. But had it not been for the bar scene, I don't think a lot of us ever would have gotten to that point, because we wouldn't have met the partners we have. We wouldn't have met the people that were working beside us as activists or whatever. None of these organizations would exist if it wasn't for the bar culture cultivating those kind of relationships. Because where else were you going to meet other great gay people?
Well, I think there are a lot of organizations that were formed by people who never went to bars, you know, like Dignity and all the religious groups. They weren't spawned by the bars. First of all, I want to affirm for you that, yes, I agree completely that our history, we would not be where we are if there had not been bars. Right. But we got to a certain point, like in the early 70s, where, you know, in 1969, which is, you know, when Stonewall happened, that's the date of the creation of tons of organizations across the country. You know, just, you know, all kinds of groups formed in 1969, 1970, et cetera. And I agree with you, you know, that having a, that was John Money, right? That you had.
Yes.
Yeah. He was pioneer. And from the moment that I was fired in 74, I was invited to speak at all these colleges. And at one college, Gettysburg, I find out later that one of the kids in the room was Carson Kressley.
Oh, wow.
And he was asked years later, how did you know you could come out? And he said, because they had Brian McNutt come and speak. And so a couple of years ago, I got a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Stonewall National Museum. And I wrote to Carson. I said, would you consider coming down and giving it to me? He said, oh, yes, absolutely. So that was a really fun night to have Carson come down and tell the story about how seeing me being happy and proud and healthy and articulate had a huge influence on his own sense of self-esteem, which was nice.
Yeah, what I meant by when I was talking about the organizations is many of the people that I've interviewed, whether they're with the executive director of Equality Florida or the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force or whatever.
Yeah.
While they may have formed in, you know, other casual environments, they all say the same thing. They never would have made the impact they do now if it had not been for the support of the bars, because the bars is where they raised the money and they also got the backing of all these other people. Now,
that's right.
The religious organizations obviously are a different story, but.
Yeah. The bars were our churches. You know, the Black community had the church to organize them. We had the bars.
Right.
That was home. And a lot of the bars, as you say, became the site of fundraisers, you know, for AIDS, for whatever it was that we needed money. Also, politicians who were supportive of, you know, in the beginning, there were very few openly gay people running for office. Elaine Noble is a friend of mine, you know, the first lesbian to ever be elected to a state house. In 1974, believe it or not. That's where politicians would often go, straight politicians, and talk about their support of gay people and raise money, you know, that way. So you're right. The bars were our churches. And we drew a lot of strength, from the bars and from the bar owners,
right,
and the bar managers. You know, they were essential.
Now, my understanding is that at your time in Boston from the late 70s, from 76 on, that was around the same time that Barney Frank was coming on the scene, too.
Yeah.
And he was not out at that time, correct?
No. It was Ray and I helped Gary Studs and Barney Frank come out of the closet. I remember... everyone knew that Barney was gay, except this is a great story. When I first got to Boston, Barney Frank was running against Elaine Noble for a seat in the Massachusetts House. And Barney called me at home. I didn't know him, but he said, you know, I'd like your support. And I said, Barney, I can't. I said, I have to vote for the openly gay person. And he wasn't able at that point to say, well, you know, I am gay. He said, okay. So, but everyone knew Barney was gay, but no one would say it. You know, Barney wouldn't say it and no one else would say it. So I was at a meeting at Bob Farmer's house. Now, Bob Farmer was the national treasurer of the Democratic National Committee. And, you know, all the big, openly gay people in Massachusetts were at that meeting, and Barney. And all the guys at the end of the night hugged each other, right, but shook Barney's hand, right? The only person in the room. So when I had the chance, I went up to Barney and I hugged him, and he whispered in my ear, thank you. You know, and you know, he asked me one time if I would meet with a Catholic who he wanted to date, who was struggling with his faith and being gay. Gary Studs, I met at the he was the first one out, you know, I met him at the Watergate. That's where he lived. At the first March on Washington, a friend who knew Gary invited me. And I said to him, I said, is Gary gay? And my friend said, oh, you never asked that. No one ever asked that. I said, okay. So when we got to his apartment, I said, hi, I'm Brian McNaught. I write a column in the Gay Press. He said, oh, I'm gay too. And my friend's eyes, you know, almost popped out because he had never said that. So Ray and I would have Gary to every Christmas party. And for the longest time, Gary would stand like a statue next to the fireplace. He wouldn't move. He was terrified. He was socially, you know, uncomfortable. Barney's not all that comfortable socially either. But with time, Gary started to meet people and relax and had an easier time, you know, acknowledging who he was and celebrating it. But yeah, so Gary Studs was out while I was there. Barney Frank was out while I was there. And I helped campaign for Barney after, you know, he and Elaine settled, you know, what was going on. So, you know, Edmund White talked about in his book, talked about Boston being one of the most politically active cities in the country. You know, you look at who's head of organizations today, and so many of them were from Gay Community News. Irva Shivad and Richard Burns, right? Tim McFeely, Eric Rofus, all of these people were people who worked in Boston and often as editors of Gay Community News.
And you were one of the pioneers right there with them, having yep. the first mayoral position, you know.
But our, I was a threat. One of my problems in my early life was that you know, there's a lot of anger at the Catholic Church in the gay community, justifiable. You know, I don't identify as Catholic anymore. I haven't for years. But there's this huge animosity towards Catholics. And here I was, an openly gay Catholic who was getting this position. And so people from the Fag Rag Collective, which is the, you know, furthest left paper that's ever existed in the gay community, they made posters up with my picture on it and plastered them on the trees in the Boston Common. And it said, Brian McNaught, the new liaison, invites you to a public orgy in the Boston Common. Bring toys and boys, slings and things, co-sponsored by Dignity and Integrity. See, they were going to grab the Episcopalians too while they were at it. So it took a long time for me to build trust among people who were suspicious that because I was Catholic, I was anti-choice or I was faithful to church teaching, which I wasn't at all, you know. In fact, one time when I was in this major department store that sold televisions, I was in the television department and they had like 50 televisions on all at the same time, right? And they were all on the same channel. And the person on the channel was Cardinal Law, who was the cardinal of in Boston at the time. So I walked around and I changed every channel of every television in the room so that no one would have to look at cardinal law. I told the story to a group of gay Catholics and they cheered. And I said, you know what? I should have just left the room. Why should I put energy into reacting to law when it's easier just to walk out of the room?
But fortunately, because of your experience, not only in the Catholic Church, but in the political arena, as an activist, as an educator, it's given you the inspiration to write quite a number of books that all focus on LGBT topics of in different parts of the spectrum. And because of that, we have more material out there. I'm looking right now at your On Being Gay and Gray, which I think is your latest book.
It's my 13th book.
Now that is odd, because a gentleman that I just interviewed about a week ago, he had just published his 13th book as well.
No, I'm not kidding. Who is that?
David Dominé.
Okay.
It's a great book called A Dark Room in Glitterball City about a gay murder in Louisville.
All right. Well, I only have one fiction, but it's based on fact, and it's called Sex Camp, and it's required reading in the University of Maine's graduate program in human sexuality. I have a couple children's books out. One's called What's Gay, Ask May. It's about two kids in a garden. She asked her cousin, who happens to be black, what's gay? And the birds give the answers all around them. You know, the first one said, you know, it's a way to love. It's a way to love. Now, I wanted all my grand nieces and nephews to hear about gay in a positive context, right? So I wrote this book, and then a friend who makes movies said, Brian, I want to make a movie out of your book. So there's this movie out, Art, called What's Gay, Ask May. It's only 3 minutes long. And you can see it at sexsmartfilms.com. It's called What's Gay, Ask May. I love it. It's a fun story. And the voices of the kids are actually my two of my grandnieces and nephews, which is wonderful. What a world we live in, huh? That my nephew and niece would have their children be the voices in my gay children's book.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. We've come a long way, and you've seen a lot of that journey.
Some of the most exciting work I did, I spoke at about 100 colleges over 10 years, and then corporations asked me to come in, and I was the first person ever to do a training on gay issues in a corporation, and you know it went from Bellcore to Bell Labs to AT&T to Motorola to all across the country, all these corporations. And then the banks found me and they brought me to London. And then they brought me to Mumbai and Tokyo and Singapore and Hong Kong and Melbourne and Sydney. Toronto Dominion Bank had me train 40 different groups all across Canada because they wanted to make sure that their workplaces were safe for gay people and transgender people. And that was really exciting work. And I wanted to tell you, with you being the bar expert, I don't know if you go beyond the U.S., but when I was in Singapore and Ray came with me, we asked our guide, who was a former big bodyguard, straight, we said, we'd like to go to a gay bar. And he said, okay, we'll go to Four Floors of Whore. And I said, what? He said, well, it's like a shopping center. It's four floors with escalators, but every floor is just bars. And the top bar is a gay bar. So we went up the escalators, you know, three floors, four floors, and we got in there. And it was filled with all these beautiful cross-dressers or transsexuals. You never know for sure whether the person...
Right.
We said, don't you have any bars that have, you know, where men go and just are dressed as men? And he said, oh, who would want to go to that? We said, we do. So the next day when I was speaking to this Singaporean group, I told them, I said, last night we went to the four floors of horror. And they all laughed because they all knew, you know, exactly what it was. Everyone in Singapore knew about the four floors of horror. Pretty funny.
Now that's interesting.
Yeah.
And I know you were just talking about being an early pioneer in the gay diversity training world. As I recall, the New York Times actually labeled you as the godfather of gay diversity training.
They did. What that meant basically was that I was not only the first person to do training, and I wrote a book called Gay Issues in the Workplace. And it's been inducted into the Library of Congress. Every corporation that I spoke at would ask, would you please make sure it's available to everybody, you know, in the room. And Art, I also asked that before I come, I'd like all the senior people in the corporation to read my book on public transportation, either on an airplane, on a bus, on a train. I want you to pull the book out and read it. And of course, there's giggling about that. But so when I spoke to S.C. Johnson and Sons, the head of the corporation said, I want you to know that I read Brian's book on the airplane and the man sitting next to me got up and moved. And he said, that was the first time I got an inkling of what's going on here in terms of the discrimination people are facing, that just sitting next to me was so uncomfortable for this person who assumed I was gay because I was reading this book that had the word gay in the title.
And the world of gay diversity training, the whole diversity and inclusion aspect of the corporate world has kind of exploded in the last 5 years, 10 years.
Oh my God. They call me the godfather because I kept training all these people who said, I want to do what you're doing. And so I'd say, okay, come to one of my workshops. I'll make sure that you're allowed to come in and sit and watch what I do and watch the response to it. And so I had this little army of people who had been trained by me. And at one time I had five people who worked for me who went around and did all the workshops that I didn't have time to do. But you're right. It's now all these companies that offered diversity training in the past on race and gender now all specialize in sexual orientation and gender identity. So I say to people who call me and say, I want to do what you did, I say, don't quit your day job, please, because you will not make a living doing it anymore. I could make a living, right? Because I was the only one doing it for a long time. And then I was considered the best. So they would pay a lot of money to have me come in. But if you're just wanting to start now, you need to diversify. You need to talk about other issues because you can't make a living just talking about gay. You have too much competition.
Yeah, there's a lot of people out there. When I look through my LinkedIn profile, I have, I think, 8,500 connections on LinkedIn. And when I look through my LinkedIn feed, I see more people that are somehow affiliated with diversity and inclusion than probably any other single category in the
and Art, you know what's next? You know, coach, life coach. I said, there are more gay men who are both realtors and life coaches. I can't believe, everyone's a life coach. And I don't put it down. You know, I'm a life coach. If somebody wants guidance on their life, wants to call and talk to me, I'm happy to do it. So I'm coaching them. But so if you have that many followers on LinkedIn, please let them know about On Being Gay and Gray, because when you self-publish, which I've had to do for the last several books, because publishing world has totally changed. You know, my former editor at St. Martin's read my manuscript for On Being Gay and Gray. And, you know, they sold 50,000 copies of On Being Gay. So I thought it's going to be natural that St. Martin's Press, after 4 months, he got back to me and said, Brian, I like your book, but we can't make enough money if we try to publish it. We won't make. So it's all about the dollar now. You know, yeah. It's all about shareholder value. So most of us, a lot of us are publishing through Amazon, which is free. But the only way we get to let people know about it is through social media and people like you who have lots of followers.
Well, absolutely. And I will put links to, you know, your books and your website and everything.
Thanks.
On my website where I list all of the individual video segments and also in slides at the end of the video, I always include information where people can find more, because the whole idea, as you know, whether you're doing diversity training or you're doing political activism or you're doing research on gay history, whatever it is, the point is not for me to have all the information. The point is for me to share the information.
Absolutely.
And that's what my project is all about. I want people to be able to find resources outside of my little world that give them more information on the same topic or related topics.
And your link to the Stonewall National Museum in Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah, and I've been down there. We have actually in this series, we have an entire episode that was narrated by the executive director of the Stonewall Museum, giving kind of a tour and overview of what that facility is all about. And I think that is a great resource. What I particularly like about them over some of the other archives that are out there is that they are open to the public. So many archives are hidden in university corridors and boxed up on shelves out of reach, but you can actually walk into the Stonewall, and as a member, you can go in there, you can read a book that was written by a gay author or about a gay subject right there. I believe you can check them out if you're a member.
You don't even have to be a member. You know, you can come into the Stonewall. You know, membership helps finance, but you can come into Stonewall, find a book, because there are thousands of books. You know, Ray and I have donated over 400 books to Stonewall, and we have a huge collection of artifacts from lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender history. We actually have our own display cases there for our collection. But you can go in and walk around, and if you want to get into the archives, you just have to, you know, tell them you're doing research. You can't take materials out of the building, but you can do research in the building. So we're an archive, which is, you know, paper materials. We're a library for books and tapes, videotape, but we're also a museum that collects artifacts. You know, for instance, I called Barney Frank, and I contacted, you know, all the people in my life that I know who were leaders, are leaders in the gay community. And I said, okay, Barney, we want something of yours that helps tell the tale of Barney Frank. You know, because people relate to images. He said, Brian, why don't I send you the gavel that ended Don't Ask, Don't Tell? Nancy Pelosi gave it to me. That's great, you know? So he sent us the gavel. So we have the gavel there. The projector that Vito Russo, you know, he wrote the book on gay people in cinema. Incredible research book. We have the projector that he used in his living room to watch these films. Those are pretty exciting things to have.
And the thing that's nice about it is, unlike a university environment, you know, it's right on a street corner. It's right on the edge of Wilton Manors. You can walk right in there. The people who work there are mostly volunteers. They're friendly. They're knowledgeable. Yeah. It's not like going into your local library and whispering behind the counter, do you know if I can find a gay thing? They know what's in there. You can go in there and say, hey, I'm looking for something about, you know, gay Boston in the 1980s. And that will lead you right to where it is. And there should be more of those. There should be 100. Every major city in the country should have one of those.
Well, you know what, Art? The future is going to be that it's all going to be virtual. You know, my suggestion, I can't do this myself, but my suggestion is that we create a virtual museum that anyone in the world can, you know, find on the internet. You're shown walking into this building, and you walk down a corridor, and they have all these rooms, And in every room, the docent will speak whatever language you want spoken to cover. Let's say you want to look at gay people in Harlem, you know, the Harlem Renaissance. Okay, it's in this room. You know, do you want a Latino or do you want Chinese or do you want, you know, what language do you want?
Right.
And that's and we won't then need to own all this stuff. All we'd have to do is, you know, take it from another site and show a picture of it. Harvey Milk speaking, you know, we don't have to own that, but we can find out where it is and get a link to it.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
Yeah, I hope that's the future.
On my website, I have a page that's called Archives. And on the Archives page, I list links to the websites of as many archives as I've interacted with, so that if you want to go and see what the, you know, Gay and Lesbian Archives of Middle America has in their system, you can go to their website. You can find them, because
that's
it's taken me years to track down where all these archives are. There are so many of them, but they're not interconnected. You know,
Art, tell me how you got into this.
So the story is kind of simple and somewhat related a little bit to Boston. After I had gone to the bar with Mark and then was going to bars in Nashville, Tennessee, I met a guy there in Nashville that I started dating. He was actually a birthday gift from a friend of mine. My friend was taking me to dinner for my birthday. He said, I didn't know what to get you for your birthday, so I brought this. Chris and I hit it off. And about a year later, we decided that we were going to travel down to Atlanta for New Year's weekend. So we went down to Atlanta. We got a hotel. And for New Year's Eve, we were at a bar in Atlanta called Backstreet, which was also owned by the Vera family.
No kidding.
Ray,
yes. Ray and I lived in Atlanta for 3 years.
Well, Henry Jr.'s brother, Carmen, moved to Atlanta in the early 70s, I believe. And he opened, he had Backstreet and about six other bars in Atlanta, most of them gay bars. Backstreet was what inspired me to move to Atlanta. A couple of years ago, I was having a conversation with Carmen's daughter, Vicky Vera, who, with her brother Henry, ran Backstreet for quite a number of years. And she said, you know, we're coming up on the 45th anniversary of the day we opened, and we'd like to do, you know, a nice commemorative design that maybe can be on a t-shirt or something, because we have over 10,000 active members of our I Partied at Backstreet page on Facebook. And they're always talking to this day about Backstreet, which has been closed for 15 years. So I started researching Backstreet a little bit more. I had plenty of experience there, but you want to get your facts right. And so I started researching, and I produced this design, and I made it a fundraiser for the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence in Atlanta, and raised money for them and sold hundreds of t-shirts. And then I started thinking, as I was talking to people about Backstreet, they would say, do you remember this other bar? Do you remember the Far Library? Do you remember the Cove? Do you remember? And so little by little, I started researching those bars, and I maybe did about six or eight of them in the next couple of months. And then COVID hit. And when COVID hit, my lifestyle changed completely. I wasn't going out strolling around the malls just for no reason. I wasn't going out to dinner every night. I wasn't going to the bars, because you didn't do that. So I was spending all my time researching more bars. In the next year, the next 12 months, I got up to about 1,000 bars around the country that I had discovered. Most all of them were gone, and found their addresses and when they were open, and found all of their logos, every single one of them. Now I'm up to about 1,700, but I have another couple thousand I know about, but I haven't necessarily tracked down their logo or their exact street address. I just know from somebody saying, oh yeah, I went to, you know, Matty O'Hattie's in 1984 and, you know, Chicago. And I'm like, can you tell me anything else about it?
Right.
But little by little, as you've make more and more connections. You find out about it. So anyway, after I got about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, it occurred to me that it's great to be able to find all the logos and some information, but not everybody's going to read it. Not everybody's going to scroll through all these lists. So I decided I was going to start to interview people who had memories of the gay bar scene from back in the day. And I was fortunate enough to connect with a couple of people early on that had some star power or recognition. I did Jimmy James, who, of course, is a very well-known performer in the gay scene back then. Del Shores, who's done movies and TV shows. A number of other people, some celebrity performers like Chad Michaels and Frank Marino, and bar owners that have had bars for 20, 30, 40 years. And I started building this inventory of oral histories. In less than a year, I am now up to, you are number 72. So I've done 72 interviews, and they're all available online. So people can...
How do you make a living?
Well, I do some small business marketing work. I have some retirement income.
Okay.
I have, you know, a couple of people that have supported the project. But it's just kind of a labor of love now. I just have to do it. I can't imagine stopping at any point.
I think it's really cool, you know, and I love your logo. I mean, it's just, it's very clever. And what you're doing is really important. I mean, telling this story that no one probably would have told as thoroughly.
Well, as you know, from your experience in the gay world, so much of our history that's documented is about politics and revolution and legislation and riots. And it's not about the bar scene. And to me, in my life, and many of the lives of people I've spoken to, the bar scene really had an impact on where their lives went. It changed their perspective of themselves. It gave them a sense of dignity and confidence that allowed them to be who they are. And they may not have otherwise become gay filmmakers or gay bar owners or, you know, gay writers, or they may not have gone anywhere because they would have been in the closet and hiding from themselves, possibly committed suicide or, you know, a tragedy. So I think it's important to look at the bright side. And recently I've started including also in those stories, the stories of bars that are still open, because I kept asking myself through the project, why didn't somebody do this when Backstreet was open? Why didn't somebody do this when, you know, the Far Library was open? And then I said to myself one day, Art, you're not doing it either. You're focusing on the ones that are gone. So I just recently did an interview with two guys who own Moby Dick in San Francisco. That's been 40 years. It's certainly worthy of commemorating.
Absolutely.
And I have several others lined up with people who own bars that have been around, mostly bars that have been around for a while, because it's going to be history at some point. If it's not really history today, it's going to be history tomorrow or next year. So
it's our story. You're saving and telling a really important story. Are you going to have a book that comes out of it?
I'm hoping. There is a page on my website about books, and the conflict has been, originally I thought, yeah, I'm going to do a book. And then I got up to 1,000 bars and 1,700 bars, and I said, how do you include 1,700 bars in a book? Who's going to read that book? If it's one page per bar, it's going to be the biggest book on the planet. Nobody's going to look at it.
Yeah.
And I started narrowing down topics, and I think eventually there will be some book versions on specific topics, types of bars or situations. For instance, bars that are involved in some sort of murder or mayhem. There have been a number of bars associated with gay murders or arson or being attacked by people either within or outside the community. There's a lot of small town bars that have kind of interesting perspectives that nobody will ever know about because there was only one in Eureka, Arkansas or something. So yeah, I hope there will be.
I think you're in a perfect position to talk about how bars impacted the, you don't have to name 1700 bars. You could just like lift yourself up above like a bird looking down and, you know, just ask the sub. So what would have happened if there had been no bars? How have the bars impacted our identity and our movement? And so, you know, who better to tell the story than somebody who's done all this research?
Well, thank you. And I will definitely add that to the list.
I'll help you.
There's an educator from Oberlin College, I think he is, by the name of Gregor Mattson, who is working on a book right now that is due to come out this year, I think, called Who Needs Gay Bars? And it's a double-edged question. It's like, do we really need gay bars? Or you can interpret it as who in the community actually does need gay bars? And he addresses that issue. But my favorite line is from a movie. I interviewed Todd Stevens, who wrote The Edge of 17, like 25 years ago, a groundbreaking movie. And most recently, Swan Song, which is about an octogenarian gay drag queen who kind of breaks out of a retirement home and goes to relive his younger days in downtown Sandusky, Ohio. Wow. And in that movie, the character is played by Udo Kier, and Udo walks into the old bar that he used to perform in and finds out it's their final night, they're closing. And he says in the movie with his German accent, "But there will we dance." And it was,
but
just,
there, but
where will we dance?
Oh, where will we dance?
You know, it was such a, the way he said it, and it was like, we're losing our community. We're losing our connection to our own people, and we're going to start meeting random people at Applebee's or something. So,
yeah.
But I agree. I the gay bars have played a huge role, and having people like you in the community, you know, being able to do some writing for the community to express our stories, to be able to work in within the political system to help make us a better part of the community. All these things come together and brought us from where we were in the 60s to where we are now. And I can't thank you enough for what you've done and for taking the time to talk to us today.
No, thanks. I'm grateful to be asked. And I love talking about the subject and, you know, letting me go back into my past and thinking, you know, more and more about the bars. And, you know, so many people today, though, you ask, and our time is probably up, but I ask people today, you know, so where did you meet couples? In the past, they would always say a bar. And what I hear now is online. You know, we met online. And I thought, wow, you know, so what are the bars for? Well, I think it's still a place that you take somebody who has never been in an environment where they felt normal.
That concludes another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show.